Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about Tech Tent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent. Hello and welcome to Tech Tent, your weekly guide to what's hot in the technology business with me, Rory Kethlen-Jones. And this week we've got a fascinating story about why the popular game Minecraft was caught up in the world's biggest cyber attack. We'll also be hearing about the battle in Europe against fake news and how Samsung stands accused of involvement in a corruption scandal in South Korea. Joining me from the BBC Technology News Desk to take us through all those stories is Zoe Kleinman. Hello, Zoe.
Hello, Rory.
First time I've seen you since Las Vegas and CES. How have you recovered?
I've just about got over the jet lag, I think. How about you?
I'm there. I'm running. I'm not on empty anymore. And my very special guest is the co-founder of the Tech Hub startup community, Elizabeth Varley. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello, it's great to be here.
Last time we did a live programme from your offices in London. This week, you're at our place. Here's a flavour of what's coming up.
I believe in self-regulatory measures. Fake news is bad, but Minister of Truth is even worse.
Sometimes people refer to South Korea as the Republic of Samsung because of the size, the economic size, but also the influence.
All of that soon. But first this week, the fascinating tale of how a game aimed at children ended up as a battleground for massive cyber attacks. Last year, a wave of attacks on big websites was launched by a botnet. That's an army of hijacked computers called Mirai. In this case, it was thousands of online devices like webcams which were commandeered, sparking a panic about the security of the Internet of Things. Now, one victim of those attacks, the security researcher Brian Krebs, his website was taken down in the attacks, has published a major investigation into the origins of Mirai and the people behind it. The most extraordinary aspect of his story is his claim that it was a battle over the popular educational game Minecraft which led to the creation of the Mirai botnet. It appears that Mirai was designed to launch attacks on very lucrative servers which host Minecraft and on the companies which offer them security protection. One of those on the receiving end was Robert Coelho, whose firm Proxypipe helps clients deal with attacks. He told me why this was all so damaging.
We can't have servers down more than 10 seconds at a time. If the player receives any issues for more than 10 seconds, then they just quit.
So your business is making sure that people playing Minecraft get an uninterrupted service and effectively guaranteeing them against the kind of attacks that could interrupt their play.
Basically, we need to actually mitigate the attacks immediately as they occur. Minecraft's very competitive, and there's a lot of bad actors in Minecraft because obviously a lot of servers are ran by people who are underage, and there's a lot of money involved. So attacks are very frequent.
And what actually happened to your business?
We're a huge target, basically. We do most of the servers. And if somebody wants to make a rival DDoS mitigation company, they're obviously going to go after us. We receive these 300 gigabit, 400 gigabit, and obviously the Mirai floods. We received all of those, the 300 gigabit in 2014. We've received the 400 gigabit in 2015 and the Mirai floods in 2016.
Just to put this into context for people who are not aware, what scale of attack is that?
I think those are easily on the top 10 attacks ever. And I think the Mirai flood is the number one attack ever.
And the result of those attacks was that your customers were going to go elsewhere?
Basically, that's exactly how it works. The customers would move to a company that does not attract very large attacks.
And were you aware of where the attacks were coming from?
Yeah, we had our suspicions, but it doesn't really benefit us to know where they're coming from because we were losing customers at the moment. We're a very real-time company. So even a pending law enforcement investigation won't help us because the damage is already done.
And have you any confidence that law enforcement might, although it would be too late for you, that law enforcement might be able to identify the perpetrators and do something about them?
Yeah, we're actively talking to the FBI about this, and we're very hopeful that we'll actually be able to have something done this time.
But it does feel like the Wild West out there, the Minecraft world. Parents will think of it as somewhere where their kids go to play. Actually, there's a kind of a war going on, a sort of cyber war underway in that world.
Yeah, it's gotten a lot better since Mirai is gone. I guarantee that. But there is definitely something still there. And it's just a competition, but it's a different type of competition because a lot of these companies that run these Minecraft servers are normally operated by people that are underage.
That was Robert Coelho of ProxyPipe. An extraordinary fact how young some of the people involved in these online battles are. Elizabeth Farley from the Tech Hub startup community. You've got lots of tiny companies under your wing, as it were, or being helped out. Is this a big fear for them, that their whole business could effectively be wiped out by these sort of attacks?
We see such a variety of different tech companies, from single-person founders just getting started through to 50, 100 people companies. Their level of activity around security and their concerns about it are really quite varied. I think what they're looking at is the difference between a sort of very specific targeted attack, for which they're not necessarily a great target when they're a smaller company, but when there's automated trawling for vulnerabilities, then everybody can be potentially
Everyone can be a target, and this could be, you know, business threatening. I mean, the guy we were just speaking to, he made it clear that if they didn't do something about this, it effectively go out of business.
Yeah, we see that that in certain sectors, particularly areas like e-commerce and retail, where obviously you're turning over money all the time, and fintech and those sorts of companies, their prime concern is around security because they've got a lot of customer data.
And it's not just the data. If they're not online, they're not doing business. We're going to hear a lot about that. More about that over the coming year, I'm sure. Now, we've talked a lot about the spread of fake news on social media as it related to the presidential campaign in the United States. But now it's heading up the agenda in Europe. With vital elections ahead this year in both France and Germany, there's concern that voters shouldn't be deliberately misled by what they read online. In Germany, Facebook announced that it was taking action to help its users identify fake stories. They will then be passed on to a small investigative journalism and fact-checking outfit called Corrective, which will examine them. David Schraven from Corrective told me about his organisation and its new mission.
Corrective is a non-profit newsroom in Germany. We are working on in-depth investigations, and we also do fact-checking. We are an organization financed by individuals as well as through foundations who support us with a couple of grants. Right now, we're just having a look how it could work, how it would be possible to check fake news on Facebook. I think the problem of fake news in Germany is growing. And this year, we've got a major election for the Bundestag, for our parliament, and we see that populists all over Germany are using fake news to change the mood of the people, you know. And from my point of view, it's very important to make a good decision in elections to know as much as possible about the truth in a society.
That's David Schraven of Corrective, who's got a big job ahead of him. Lots of fake stories suddenly bubbling up in Germany. So Facebook's taking action, but is there a role here for governments and regulators? At this week's World Economic Forum in the Swiss resort of Davos, Joe Miller caught up with Andrus Ansip, the European Commission Vice President, whose brief covers digital democracy. He wasn't convinced of the need for heavy-handed action.
I believe in self-regulatory measures. Fake news is bad, but Minister of Truth is even worse. People that are able to understand what kind of sources they can trust and what kind of sources they don't have to trust. So maybe because of fake news, more and more people, they will return to traditional media, because fact-checking when talking about BBC or other sources is a must.
But you don't see a role for the EU in regulating online news, in regulating social media?
This is too broad question, but to create some kind of a ministry of truth, it's a bad idea. I don't think states or state institutions, they have to say what is correct and what is fake.
Do you think the responsibility lies with consumers of news, with readers, or with these large tech companies who share the news and who publish the news?
At first, those large tech companies.
We're talking here of things like Facebook and Twitter.
Exactly. They have to take care about the content because if people, they will not trust those sources anymore, they will switch on other channels. And they will stop to use those social media channels.
So people will self-police. Is that what you're relying on?
As I said in the very beginning, I believe in self-regulatory measures. It means those platforms like Facebook, they have to edit also somehow this content on their platforms because if not, more and more people, they will lose those platforms.
That's Andras Anship, the European Commission Vice President. It seems to me, Elizabeth Varley, our special guest, that's a bit of an optimistic view of how much people care about what's true or not. That they are, if they decide that Facebook is full of fake news, they'll leave Facebook. Do you think that's going to happen?
I think people who care about fake news and what they're reading are going to be looking with a critical eye at where this information is coming from, what sources are being used. I think also that you see people reducing their the size of their friendship groups or the number of services that they'll use on something like Facebook to get information, to restrict that just to places that they feel have a strong veracity. People who aren't already aware
That's an optimistic view, isn't it? I mean, that's a minority of people who have the time and
exactly.
care enough.
Exactly, and I think this is the concern. It is a minority of people. We media studies courses are much maligned and joked about as something that sort of doesn't really help you in your career. But critical media analysis is something that we really need to be teaching people from a very early stage. It's easy for people who are educated and experienced in to look for more safe information. People who don't know that they need to be looking for other things don't know.
Let's bring Zoe Kleiman in here, Zoe. I mean, you obviously, we're practitioners, we're also consumers. Mm. Do you find it more and more difficult to spot what's real and what's fake in the online world?
I don't think so, but I do live in fear that I will fall for something one day. But I think you have to sort of remember that this is a new take on a very old story. You know, during the war, people were dropping propaganda and misinformation out of aeroplanes, weren't they, on pieces of paper. So actually, we've found perhaps a more practical way of disseminating all of this information, but we've lived with it for a very long time. And I think the debate about who should be responsible for editing or sort of policing it is so interesting, isn't it? It's like, you know, who do you want to trust to tell you what you can and can't see? It's an ethical minefield. I can understand why people like Facebook have been so reluctant to get involved. The last thing they want to do is to become a media editor because of all the responsibilities that go with it. But as we've seen, it's just something they can't avoid anymore because
they
it's
can't.
Almost like the platform's being flooded, isn't it?
It is. It's something we're going to be coming back to. You're listening to Tech 10 on the BBC World Service with me, Rory Catlin-Jones. In a moment, Samsung gets buffeted by another crisis. Take a look at some of the week's other big tech stories with the very busy Zoe Kleiman. Zoe, yet again, the taxi app service Uber is in hot water. What's happened this time?
I feel like we talk about Uber quite a lot, don't we?
Well,
Uber's going to pay $20 million to some of its drivers in America after significantly overselling the amount they could expect to earn. The US Federal Trade Commission ruled that there were 18 cities in the US where the firm told potential drivers they could earn a lot more than was likely. So to give you an example, fewer than 10% of drivers in Boston earned $25 an hour as advertised. In Chicago, fewer than 20% earned the $21 benchmark. And in Minneapolis, only 10% earned the $18 they were promised that they might be able to get. Well, Uber says it's pleased with the agreement that it's reached, but that the settlement does not constitute an admission of guilt. On our recent trip to CES in Las Vegas, Rory, I had a chat with quite an incensed licensed cab driver, actually. He told me that the ride-sharing services that had come to Las Vegas, I think about a year ago, were really starting to hurt his income. So I asked him whether he was tempted to jump ships and join the ranks of drivers working for Uber.
No, because I don't get any benefits from them, like medical benefits. I have to pay all the maintenance on the vehicle, all that stuff like that. And the difference in pay from 2015 and 2016, I took about a $7,000 loss for the year.
Are lots of people leaving your industry?
Yes, lots of people are leaving our industry because they can't make any money.
Yeah, the whole ride-sharing business has been great for consumers, perhaps not so great for the people actually driving. Another story, the movie and TV streaming service Netflix has had a pretty volatile ride on the stock market over the years, but it's been on the up this week, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. I feel like recently we were saying, oh, Netflix, you know, it's plateauing now. And now suddenly it's taken a big chance. And for once, it's paid off. The firm decided to focus on making its own original content. And it did away with the distribution deals that it had that led to hundreds of movies being taken off the service. But it has all gone to plan. They gained more than 7 million new subscribers in the last quarter of 2016. And they now look set to have reached the 100 million subscriber milestone by March this year. Netflix has a 6 billion. These figures are so big, I can't even get my head around them. $6 billion budget to produce 1,000 hours of programming in 2017. Sounds a bit like the budget for Tech 10, doesn't it, Rory?
It does, actually, yeah.
We wish. After gaining confidence from hits like The Crown, Stranger Things, and the Gilmore Girls, and it's got the money in the bank to do it because it took nearly $9 billion in revenue last year.
Elizabeth Varley, I mean, it is turning out to be one of the great successes at Netflix, isn't it? It looked like it might not make it at one stage.
Well, it's really interesting to see that creating original programming, which was not their original plan, has been so successful for them. And it's one of the things that we always talk about in the tech industry. You've got to pivot when your product isn't working.
It's made it work. And briefly, Zoe, you've got a fabulous story about cyber attacks, not cyber attacks taking businesses offline, but a rather more physical threat.
Rory, this is my favourite tech story of the week, if not the year. Security expert Chris Thomas has been tracking power outages caused by animals since 2013. He found that squirrels, birds, rats and snakes have been responsible for more than 1,700 of them. And while squirrels top the list, there were also 72 caused by raccoons, 3 by frogs, and who could forget the time a Swedish nuclear power station was knocked out by jellyfish clogging up the pipes. So many people, Rory, have been sharing their stories since I started chatting about this online. I reckon there's a series in this. We should go for it.
Yeah, definitely. My kitchen is infested with mice and I keep waiting for them to take out the internet. No, they haven't managed it so far, luckily. Now, the mobile phone giant Samsung has had a torrid time over the last few months. First, it had to withdraw its Galaxy Note 7 phone after it caught fire, and now it's been caught up in the corruption scandal involving the South Korean president, Park Chung-hee. 5 Samsung executives, including the boss, J.Y. Lee, have been questioned about allegations that bribes were paid to secure support for a merger. Now, our man in Seoul is Steve Evans. He's been telling me how central Samsung is to the South Korean economy.
Sometimes people refer to South Korea as the Republic of Samsung because of the size, the economic size, but also the influence. It is ever present throughout South Korea. Everywhere you go, you can be born in a Samsung hospital and you can end your days in a Samsung funeral home. And in between, you can live in a Samsung apartment. It is not just phones. It is pretty well everything. Huge political influence, a major player.
Now, of course, although it's had a major issue recently with its exploding Galaxy Note 7 phone, actually, times look pretty good for Samsung financially. It's been churning up pretty good profits lately. Is there concern in South Korea that all of that could be derailed by this huge corruption scandal?
I don't think there is, really. There is a split feeling about Samsung, I think, in South Korea. If you look at these protests, which there have been every single Saturday for more than 2 months now, it is a protest partly against a way of doing business, a coziness between the chaebols, particularly Samsung, and the president. And in the middle of Seoul, for example, there is a caricature of the president, the national president, the president of the country, alongside a caricature of J.Y. Lee, the acting head of Samsung. But at the same time, you can't deny that ordinary people are proud of it. You know, here is a Korean company which is, above all, a household name, and ordinary people are proud of that. even as they're not proud of the way they think the ruling family has behaved. The Korean way of business, and it came from President Park's father, the general who seized control and who then put the country on the path to industrialization, though not democracy. And his way of business, of doing business, was to tell the chaebol heads, if you don't set up an industry, if you don't invest more money, well, then I'm going to come after you for corruption. So that was a way of doing business right at the start, that way of the political power directing the economic power. And that's never gone away. Is it corrupt? The prosecutor clearly suspects it may be.
But Samsung has been through ups and downs in terms of its mobile phone business, which is now what most of the world associates with it. It's not going to be derailed by this, or is it?
I don't think so. You know, with the exploding batteries, there was a bit of a hit and on the share price, and the company wrote off. Well, firstly, the whole cost of the development of the phone, and also the revenue that would have come from it. But, you know, do people really judge companies by what goes on in the boardroom, or do they go into shops and think, that phone's cool, I'll buy that. That phone's not cool, I won't buy that one. There's no evidence at all that this row is hitting sales. And, you know, I sometimes wonder, going around Samsung stores, whether actually around the world, the row is increasing the company's profile.
Steve Evans there. And on Monday morning, Samsung will be back in the news. It's holding a press conference to announce the results of the investigation into what went wrong with that Galaxy Note 7 phone. Before we go, Elizabeth Varley, a quick word about tech locations. You're a big champion of London. President Trump is about to enter the White House in the next few hours. Will that take a bit of the weight away from Silicon Valley? Do other places see an opportunity? Will London come out on top?
I think it's really hard to speculate what's going to happen in Silicon Valley with the change in government. But I think that we're seeing London and New York doing incredibly well in the tech scene, particularly with startups. And I think we'll continue to see significant growth in both of those cities.
And briefly, one other place you could nominate, somewhere else in Europe?
Well, I'm very excited about, obviously, you know, Tech Hub is in Madrid and in Bangalore, and those are two cities that are doing incredibly well at the moment. Lots of innovation, lots of excitement.
Two top tips for you, Madrid and Bangalore. Well, we've run out of time again. Thank you very much to my special guest, Elizabeth Varley, from the Tech Hub startup community. Thanks to Zoe Kleiman from the BBC Tech News Desk. She's steering that desk today, so look out for all of her stories at bbc.com/technology. Don't forget about our podcast. Please tell all your friends about it. And join us again in the Tech Tent at the same time next week.